The king was silent. "Ents," he said at length. "Out of the shadows of legend, I begin a little to understand the marvels of the trees, I think. I have lived to see strange days. Long have we tended our beasts in our fields, built our houses, wrought our tools, or ridden away to help in the wars of Minas Tirith, and that we call the life of men, the way of the world. We cared little for what lay beyond the borders of our land. Songs we have that tell of these things, but we are forgetting them, teaching them only to the children as a careless custom. And now the songs come down among us out of strange places and walk visible under the sun." So, I would venture to say what we just read there is how you sum up Book 3 in a microcosm.
So it was that in the light of the fair morning, King Théoden and Gandalf the White Rider met again upon the green grass beside the deeping stream. There was also Aragorn, son of Arathorn, and Legolas the Elf, and Erkenbrand of Westfold, and the lords of the Golden House. About them were gathered the Rohirrim, the Riders of the Mark. Wonder overcame their joy and victory, and their eyes were turned towards the wood. Suddenly there was a great shout, and down from the dike came those who had been driven back into the deep. There came Gamling the Old, and Éomer, son of Éomund, and beside them walked Gimli the Dwarf. He had no helm, and about his head was a linen band stained with blood, but his voice was loud and strong.
42, Master Legolas, he cried. Alas, my axe is notched. The 42nd had an iron claw on its neck. How is it with you?
You have passed my score by one, answered Legolas, but I do not grudge you the game. So glad am I to see you on your legs.
Oh, what an opening. Alright, Clifford, so we're back again. Another episode.
Indeed we are.
What are we doing today?
We've got Chapter 8 of The Two Towers, The Road to Isengard.
Yeah, so we gotta talk about the whole departure from Helm's Deep. We gotta talk about passing through this forest and the very memorable conversation that takes place. Mm-hmm. We gotta talk about watching this forest move, which is bizarre. Mm-hmm. And then we got to talk about Isengard. We get to Isengard and we see some strange things.
Mm-hmm.
But before all that, Cliff's notes.
So, in the sunny morning aftermath of the Battle of Helm's Deep, the good guys reunite with joy and confusion at the forest that showed up on their doorstep in the night. Gandalf resolves to go to Isengard to speak with Saruman. Though hesitant, the others follow his lead. They make their way north across the west side of Rohan, surveying the damage and victories of the orc invasion along the way. When they finally reach Isengard, they find a once majestic fortress in partial ruin and flooded. Much to their delight, Merry and Pippin greet them at the gateway into Isengard.
Ho ho! All right, excellent. Okay, so yeah, so we read the opening already. Clifford just said the Cliff's Notes. Actually, do you have any initial thought before we...
This was a very... It was like a bright chapter almost. Like,
I know,
the chapter was. Felt like it was a nice morning after the darkness that was the last chapter and this long battle.
This was a fun one, yeah.
But it wasn't just the fact that you start the chapter in the morning. The whole chapter just felt like exhilarating in a relaxing way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like it was just like a nice like sigh after the tension and buildup of the last one.
Yeah, like you would think that this would just be kind of a boring transitional chapter. But it was actually, like you're saying, it was super pleasant and it was fun. And I surprisingly have a lot to talk about, and we're probably going to quote a lot of it because it was just so awesome.
Yeah, I guess another way of putting it is it wasn't stressful and it wasn't boring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a nice, happy medium between those.
Right. All right, so they're all meeting out there, and that was such an epic opening, too, just it's like, in the fair morning, King Théoden and Gandalf the White Rider met again, you know, like...
It seemed to me like he took the time to give them their formal, like a formal reintroduction, even though we know all the characters at this point. It was as though it was the start of a fresh book. It's and like he had to give the proper salute to each person.
Yeah, but this, and it felt like the east and west sides of the, like the Continental Railroad meeting, you know, in Utah. So.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, well, anyways, at this meeting, it seems like Éomer is the most surprised of all. And again, remember the Rohan people, especially for this chapter, you got to remember the Rohan people, they're just the normal dudes. Like, all of this stuff is just so bizarre to them.
All this stuff is in all of these things leaping out of the fairy tales they tell their children.
Right, as well, like, you know, and the ante just keeps upping every scene in this chapter.
Right.
You know, with that.
They've got wizards, guys with swords that they didn't know existed, elves, dwarves, and
whole,
now there's this
whole
forest.
Tree army, yeah.
Yeah.
And so Éomer, he says here, I'll be Éomer. The dark night has passed, and the day has come again, but the day has brought strange tidings. He turned and gazed in wonder, at first at the forest and then at Gandalf. Once more, you come in the hour of need, unlooked for, he said.
Unlooked for, said Gandalf. I said that I would return and meet you here.
But you did not name the hour, nor foretell the manner of your coming. Strange help you bring. You are mighty in wizardry, Gandalf the White. All right, so let's get down to it. Brass tacks. What's going on with this forest? Not so much in the context of Middle-earth, but, like, why would Tolkien have this come up? What do you think? I might have already told you in the warm-up, but...
It brings to mind Shakespeare.
Oh, really? Does it actually?
If I was better versed in my English literature, it would certainly call to mind Macbeth by Shakespeare, because I believe there is a moving forest in Macbeth. Right.
Well, so that's the thing. Yeah, so and so this is associated, this part is most associated with the cordially disliked Shakespeare quote. It's because he was, you know, one of the reasons or examples was he was very unimpressed with this part of Macbeth in Shakespeare.
Tolkien was.
Because in there was this prophecy that Macbeth's downfall would be preceded by when this great forest... Burnham Wood would move, would just move. And so Macbeth's like, oh, well, I'm going to be safe. No forest can move, right? You know? So it's like, I'm going to be king for a long time. But then all of a sudden, the forest does move, which Tolkien's like, oh, no way. That's super cool. But what it turns out to be, it's just the troops, they all start carrying tree branches from the forest so that they can hide their numbers as they approach the castle so that they don't know how many people are actually attacking them. And so Tolkien read that and he's just like, that's it? That's super lame. In my story, there's going to be a real forest that does move. so that's what we have here. Like, this is this is one of the biggest spitting, you know, references to Shakespeare here. Pretty fun, because this is pretty successful. Interesting move. I don't know. You got anything else? Because we could just keep going, too.
Well, as we'll see a little bit later on, this ties in, unsurprisingly, with the Ents from a few chapters back, from Merry and Pippin meeting Treebeard in Fanghorn. But it's not the same. It's a little bit different. And drag racer outside the window. But it's related, though not the same. And that was one of the very intriguing and mysterious aspects to me when I first read it. Is like, I could tell this has to do with the forest being alive, so we assume it's the Ents. But the Ents went to Isengard, as far as we know.
Right.
And these sound to be, like, these are trees, not Ents. So there's another dimension going on there, and I couldn't quite tell what was going on the first time I read it. So it
right.
I guess I understood enough that it was, like, you know, the forest has come alive to take revenge, but not enough to fully explain what exactly went down.
But anyways, let's keep moving on here. So Gandalf's, you know, Éomer's praising Gandalf, and Gandalf's basically like, ah, that was nothing, you know, like, just super shy and bashful.
Yeah, it wasn't me. It was all of your countrymen, basically.
Yeah.
With their strong legs. They marched here, and they were the army.
Yeah, let's take this next quote here. Then they all gazed at Gandalf with still greater wonder. Some glanced darkly at the wood and passed their hands over their brows, as if their eyes saw otherwise than his.
Gandalf laughed long and merrily. The trees, he said? Nay, I see the wood as plainly as do you, but that is no deed of mine. It is a thing beyond the counsel of the wise. better than my design, and better even than my hope the event has proved.
Then if not yours, whose is the wizardry, said Théoden? Not Saruman's, that is plain. Is there some mightier sage of whom we have yet to learn?
It is not wizardry, but a power far older, said Gandalf. A power that walked the earth ere elf sang or hammer rang. Ere iron was found or tree was hewn, when young was mountain under moon, ere ring was made or wrought was woe, it walked the forest long ago.
And what may be the answer to your riddle? Said Théoden.
If you would learn that, you should come with me to Isengard, answered Gandalf.
To Isengard, they cried.
Yes, said Gandalf. I shall return to Isengard, and those who will may come with me. There we may see strange things.
But there are not now enough men in the Mark. Not if they all shall gather together and healed of the wounds and weariness to assault the stronghold of Saruman, said Théoden.
Nevertheless, to Isengard I go, said Gandalf.
All right, so that's a weird twist.
Mm-hmm.
After defeating the massive army, and, you know, they're definitely beaten up, we're literally on the morning of it, Gandalf's like, okay, now we're going to Isengard.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's multiple weird things. First of all, he seems to kind of know what's going on with the forest, but he says, basically, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have anything to do with this. Go ask the next guy. And, yeah. By the way, do you want to march straight into the fortress of the army that just nearly beat us?
Yeah, this might be his peak cryptic level.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, this wizard... He's been playing stuff close to the chest forever, this might be the biggest.
I think it's worth making the point here, just knowing what they know, knowing what the Rohan folks know at this point, going to Isengard is like suicide. Like they have just faced this massive army that marched out of Isengard and won, just barely, but Isengard is like this power that's, you know, right up against their border, has been tormenting them for, has been pushing the limit for, it sounds like, years, and has recently mounted a more full-fledged attack. And so Gandalf is suggesting just strolling into the center of all their woes without an army. So it sounds totally crazy to them.
But he says, there we may see strange things. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's hopeful.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, yeah, clearly he's optimistic, but he won't say much about why.
Yeah. Okay, so at this point, Théoden, he says, I doubted you before dawn, but no longer. I'm going with you if you ask. And then Gandalf says, like, well, yeah, I want to talk to Saruman, and it'd be pretty good if you're there too, especially because he hurts you guys so bad. Like, it's good if you guys have a rep. And then Gandalf decides, like, all right, so we'll leave at evening. It's better to just cover our movements from here on out anyways, with, you know, covered by using darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And they select that Théoden, Éomer, 20 men, Gandalf, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli will all go to Isengard. So that's about, what, 25, 26 guys?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so interesting party choice to go to a great stronghold.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gandalf in here... he states something along the lines of, he says, but do not command many men to go with you, Théoden. We go to a parley, not a fight. So Gandalf specifically doesn't want too many people. He wants it to be a messenger party, basically, and not a fighting force.
Right. All right, so they go to bed, and everybody else cleans up. Anyways, the Dunlending men, some of them were spared, and so they, you know, the Rohirrim, specifically Erkenbrand, Erkenbrand says, like, hey, you know, you guys screwed up, but now redeem yourselves and just help us clean up the mess.
And these are the so-called wild men who sided with the orcs at Sauron's behest to attack. Saruman's behest to attack Helm's Deep.
Yeah. And it turns out that Saruman was feeding them a bunch of lies about who the Rohirrim were. Like, they thought the Rohirrim would burn them alive.
Yeah, so even though Erkenbrand is putting them to work to basically make amends, they're relieved almost and quite happy to not be burned alive after this battle.
Obviously. Yeah. All right, so they bury all the dead, but then they just pile up the orc bodies because they don't really know what else to do with them. And then Gandalf and Théoden and everybody saddles up to depart. So to depart, these trees are blocking the whole valley, so they do have to go through them. And everybody's kind of nervous about this. Do you want to read that quote?
The trees were gray and menacing, and a shadow or a mist was about them. The ends of their long, sweeping boughs hung down like searching fingers. Their roots stood up from the ground like the limbs of strange monsters, and dark caverns opened beneath them. But Gandalf went forward, leading the company, and where the road from the Hornburg met the trees, they saw now an opening like an arched gate under mighty boughs. And through it Gandalf passed, and they followed him. Then to their amazement they found that the road ran on, and the deepening stream beside it, and the sky was open above and full of golden light. But on either side the great aisles of the wood were already wrapped in dusk, stretching away into impenetrable shadows. And there they heard the creaking and groaning of boughs, and far cries, and a rumor of wordless voices, murmuring angrily. No orc or other living creature could be seen. Legolas and Gimli were now riding together upon one horse, and they kept close behind Gandalf, for Gimli was afraid of the wood.
"It is hot in here," said Legolas to Gandalf. "I feel a great wrath about me. Do you not feel the air throb in your ears?"
"Yes," said Gandalf.
"What has become of the miserable orcs?" said Legolas.
"That, I think, no one will ever know," said Gandalf.
Creepy. Creepy. All right, so they're walking through the woods at this point.
Yeah, air of mystery still, but it seems like things are going their way, right?
Right. You know, Gandalf's basically like, just keep cool and we'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen examples in the story before, both with the hobbits starting out in, remind me of the name of the forest.
The Old Forest.
The Old Forest near the Shire.
Yeah.
And then again in Fanghorn, and to an extent in The Hobbit in Mirkwood. The ability of forests to shape the paths within them and for companies that walk into forests to get drawn down certain routes. So sometimes in a malicious way, but here it seems that the same thing's going on, but in a good way. They're being drawn down this path, but it seems to be the right direction.
All right, so now Clifford... We come to it. This is one of those scenes where when you read the books for the first time, it's one of those scenes that's not in the movie, but it sticks with everybody. Like, everybody remembers this scene, and they might not remember it for good reason, but it's so... I still remember the very first time I ever read it for reasons that we'll say afterwards, but we could easily pass this up and just say that it happened, but I want to read it because... I think it deserves to be read. And this is one of the best conversations that Legolas and Gimli have together. And I can't see how we can pass it up. I don't care if this takes, you know, a significant chunk of time longer. So I'll be Gimli and you're going to take Legolas. All right.
Okay.
So they're walking through, they're riding on the same horse walking through the woods here.
I thought you were going to take Legolas and I was going to take Gimli.
No way. No. Clifford, we said throughout Two Towers, we're developing, like, certain characters are more associated with you than with me. Because it's usually one-on-one for most of these things.
Right. You know, I know, you claimed Aragorn.
Yeah.
You claimed Pippin.
You get most of the elves. You get elves above me, and you get, you get like, Gandalf above me. Like, I take the men and the dwarf. So Gimli starts here. He says,
No, I think this is Legolas reading right now, and then Gimli responds.
Oh, really? All right, well then you start.
Okay. "These are the strangest trees that I ever saw," Legolas said, "and I have seen many an oak grow from acorn to ruinous age. I wish that there were leisure now to walk among them. They have voices, and in time I might come to understand their thought."
"No, no," said Gimli. "Let us leave them. I guess their thought already. Hatred of all that go on two legs, and their speech is of crushing and strangling."
"Not of all that go on two legs," said Legolas. "There I think you are wrong. It is orcs that they hate, for they do not belong here and know little of elves and men. Far away are the valleys where they sprang, from the deep dales of Fanghorn, Gimli. That is whence they come, I guess."
"Then that is the most perilous wood in Middle-earth," said Gimli. "I should be grateful for the part that they have played, but I do not love them. You may think them wonderful, but I have seen a greater wonder in this land, more beautiful than any grove or glade that ever grew. My heart is still full of it. Strange are the ways of men, Legolas. Here they have one of the marvels of the northern world, and what do they say of it? Caves. Or caves, they say. Caves. Holes to fly to in time of war, to store fodder in. My good Legolas, do you know that the caverns of Helm's Deep are vast and beautiful? There would be an endless pilgrimage of dwarves merely to gaze at them, if such things were known to be. Aye, indeed, they would pay pure gold for a brief glance.
And I would give gold to be excused, said Legolas, and double to be let out if I stayed in.
You have not seen, so I forgive your jest, said Gimli, but you speak like a fool. Do you think those halls are fair where your king dwells under the hill in Mirkwood, and dwarves helped in their making long ago? They are but hovels compared to, with the caverns I have seen here, immeasurable halls, filled with an everlasting music of water that tinkles into pools, as fair as Kelidzarum in the starlight. And Legolas, when the torches are kindled and men walk on sandy floors under the echoing dome, ah, then, Legolas, gems and crystals and veins of precious ore glint in the polished walls, and the light glows through folded marbles, shell-like, translucent as the living hands of Queen Galadriel. There are columns of white and saffron and dawn rose, Legolas, fluted and twisted into dreamlike forms. They spring up from many-colored floors to meet the glistening pedants of the roof. Wings, ropes, curtains, fine as frozen clouds, spears, banners, pinnacles of suspended palaces, still lakes mirror them. A glimmering world looks up from dark pools, over with clear glass. Cities, such as the mind of Durin could scarce have imagined in his sleep, stretch through avenues and pillared courts, on into the dark recesses where no light can come, and plink, a silver drop falls, and the round wrinkles in the glass make all the towers bend and waver like weeds and corals in a grotto of sea. Then evening comes, they fade and twinkle out. The torches pass on into another chamber in another dream. There is chamber after chamber, Legolas, hall opening out of hall, dome after dome, stair beyond stair, and still the winding paths lead on into the mountain's heart. Caves, the caverns of Helm's Deep. Happy was the chance that drove me there. It makes me weep to leave them.
Then I will wish you this fortune for your comfort, Gimli, said the elf, that you may come safe from war and return to see them again. But do not tell all your kindred. There seems little left for them to do from your account. Maybe the men of this man are wise to say little. One family of busy dwarves with a hammer and chisel might mar far more than they made.
No, you don't understand, said Gimli. No dwarf could be unmoved by such loveliness. None of Durin's race would mine those caverns for stone or ore, not if diamonds and gold could be got there. Do you cut down groves of blossoming trees in the springtime for firewood? We would tend these glades of flowering stone, not quarry them, with cautious skill, tap by tap, a small chip of rock and no more, perhaps, in a whole anxious day. So we would work, and as the years went by, we should open up new ways and display far chambers that are still dark, glimpsed only as a void beyond fissures in the rock. And lights, Legolas, we should make lights, such lamps as once shone in Khazad Dûm, and when we wished, we would drive away the night that has lain there since the hills were made, and when we desired rest, we would let the night return.
You move me, Gimli, said Legolas. I've never heard you speak like this before. Almost you make me regret that I have not seen these caves. Come, let us make this bargain. If we both return safe out of the perils that await us, we'll journey for a while together. You shall visit Fanghorn with me, and then I will come with you to see Helm's Deep.
Oh, what a part. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's possibly my favorite part of the book so far.
Yeah.
of two towers.
That's cool. I mean, it's a great monologue from Gimli just praising the beauty that he's seen.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Just a quick point. These caves, just geography wise, these caves must have been significantly far back from like the fortress,
mm-hmm.
or else they probably would have just walked to them later that day because they had a whole day off, you know.
This is true. And you're right. You're right. And we got this suggestion of sequential layers of caves, basically,
right.
that as orcs started to attack into Helm's Deep, the people in hiding in the caves had to retreat further and further back.
Yeah. All right. But anyways, I remember reading this the very first time I ever read the books, and I was going through this, and I think in my book it had smaller pages, so this was like a 5-page thing, and it's like, oh my gosh, I am not sure I can do this. Like, Legolas and Gimli just talking about trees and caves. Like, come on. But now it's like, no. This is what it's about. These are the mm-hmm. awesome scenes for why you read these books. Because that was such an excellent description, especially by Gimli. Like, mm-hmm. that was so cool. And I don't know, this is fun. Like, that was real poetry there, you know, in writing. And it comes from Gimli, who's the least expected to be able to do that of this group that they're
right.
traveling with.
Right he's now. Been he's been the gruffest and sort of least yeah. eloquent of the bunch.
Yeah. And you know, now, like, do we have to read that? No. But we read it, so when you finally eventually read it yourself to the listeners, you're going to remember this part, and you're going to get to it, and you're going to be excited, and you're going to, like, just start rubbing your hands like, oh, yeah, let's go to town. This is going to be sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully you'll all appreciate that scene more now. It was that's, like I said, this is becoming one of my favorite scenes in the whole mm-hmm. book, because that was great.
One other interesting thing about it is we've got throughout the book, we've got the different characters and sort of races that are attached to the different landscapes. Like, elves love the forest, dwarves love underground,
yeah.
Men love open fields or what have you. So in general, you know, of course Legolas wants to talk to the trees. That's kind of like an established fact at this point.
Right.
But then this is actually a little bit more nuanced and interesting, because Gimli is now seeing caverns made by men, we presume. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh my god, these are so beautiful.
Actually, I don't think they're made by men. I think it's just natural.
Possibly so. I get the impression some of it was carved. Okay.
Well, they probably just carved, you know, holes to get through from cave to cave.
Okay. So, I mean, there's a lot of architectural language.
Mm.
Like fluted columns and pilasters and stairs and everything. So I got the impression that it was carved to some extent in the way that Moria might have been.
Okay.
But it's a little bit like when Gimli was praising Lothlorien. It was also something totally foreign to him that he was just head over heels stunned by, when normally he would have been like, oh, dwarves do it better. Okay, you know. Like, when he was in Moria, he was just like, the glorious place that this once was. If only I could see it in its older state. You know, it's kind of what the reaction we'd expect. Just like Legolas might be, oh, yeah, this forest is amazing.
Yeah.
But this is actually a more heartfelt passage where Gimli he's totally surprised as well as being impressed.
Yeah. Well, and how about how Gimli, you know, Legolas says, you move me, Gimli. So it's like Gimli's description of it, like, even Legolas the elf wants to see caves, mm-hmm. which, you know, earlier on in that conversation, he's like, couldn't pay me to go in there.
Yeah, exactly.
I paid double to get out. Pretty good. All right, so they come to the end of the forest and they come out. Gandalf says they're still 15 leagues from Isengard. Gosh, those distances, man. I don't know, that's far. Anyways, they come out of the wood and Legolas looks back, and then he sees eyes. And so he wants to go back and check it out, but Gimli's begging him not to, and Gandalf tells him not to. Even as he spoke, there came forward out of the trees three strange shapes, as tall as trolls they were, 12 feet high or more in height. Their strong bodies, stout as young trees, seemed to be clad with raiment or with hide of loose-fitting gray and brown. Their limbs were long, and their hands had many fingers. Their hair was stiff, and their beards gray-green as moss. They gazed out with solemn eyes, but they were not looking at the riders. Their eyes were bent northwards. Suddenly they lifted their hands to their mouths and sent forth ringing calls, clear as notes on a horn, but more magical and various. The calls were answered, and turning again, the riders saw other creatures of the same kind approaching, striding through the grass. They came swiftly from the north, walking like wading herons in their gait, but not in their speed, for their legs and their long paces beat quicker than the heron's wings. The riders cried aloud in wonder, and some set their hands upon their sword hilts.
"You need no weapons," said Gandalf. "These are but herdsmen. They are not enemies. Indeed, they are not concerned with us at all."
So it seemed to be, for as he spoke, the tall creatures, without a glance at the riders, strode into the woods and vanished. "Herdsmen," said Theoden, "where are their flocks? What are they, Gandalf? For it is plain that to you, at any rate, they are not strange."
"They are the shepherds of the trees," answered Gandalf. "Is it so long since you listened to the tales by the fireside? There are children in your land who, out of the twisted threads of story, could pick the answer to your question. You have seen Ents, O king. Ents of Fanghorn Forest, which in your language you call the Entwood. Did you think that the name was given only in idle fancy? Nay, Theoden, it is otherwise. To them you are but a passing tale. All the years from Errol the Young to Theoden the Old are of little count to them, and all the deeds of your house but a small matter."
The king was silent. "Ents," he said at length, "out of the shadows of legend, I begin a little to understand the marvels of the trees, I think. I have lived to see strange days. Long have we tended our beasts in our fields, built our houses, wrought our tools, or ridden away to help in the wars of Minas Tirith, and that we call the life of men, the way of the world. We cared little for what lay beyond the borders of our land. Songs we have that tell of these things, but we are forgetting them, teaching them only to the children, as a careless custom. And now the songs come down among us, out of strange places, and walk visible under the sun.
You should be glad, Théoden King, said Gandalf, for not only the little life of men is now endangered, but the life also of those things which you have deemed the matter of legend. You are not without allies, even if you know them not.
Yet also I should be sad, said Théoden, for however the fortune of war shall go, may it not so end that much that was fair and wonderful shall pass forever out of Middle-earth?
It may, said Gandalf. The evil of Sauron cannot wholly be cured, nor made as if it had not been. But to such days we are doomed. Let us now go on with the journey we have begun.
All right. So, I would venture to say what we just read there is how you sum up Book 3 in a microcosm. This is the whole thing of the book. Like, this is the biggest thing going on.
Bold statement, but I think I agree with you.
This is... We've said it before, but Rohan, the normal guy people, and look at this. Théoden, he could barely hang on and grapple with all the stuff that's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Every single crazy fairy tale is coming to life here. Mm-hmm. Like, Gandalf literally says, he's like, you gotta remember your bedtime stories, dude. You know, like, come on. Mm-hmm. You know, you've heard of these things. And Théoden's just like, I've lived to see strange days, and now the songs have come down among us out of strange places and walk visible under the sun. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just like, oh. Dude, I'm really starting to love Théoden in this read-through, like more mm-hmm. so than the past ones that I've done.
Yeah, he's very, I guess, open to having his worldview totally disrupted by Gandalf in a lot of ways.
Even if he's not open to it, it's happening.
Well, that's what I mean. He's dealing with it really well. You know, you could expect a lot of people in this situation to react with, like, anger or fear or shock, and Théoden's rolling with the punches when he's, I mean, this is completely would be completely unbelievable to him if somebody told him what he was seeing.
If somebody told him what he was seeing, what he would see just a week ago from now, like a week ago,
right?
Rohan, you know, he was in a sorry state under like Grima's power, basically Wormtongue's power, uh-huh. and his son just died or was about to die, and all of Rohan looks like it's going to be overrun and he's going to be the last king, you know, because mm-hmm. the whole place is going to be conquered and done. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Gandalf returns with a couple of strong warriors with him. He totally reinvigorates them to at least hope. And then things still look dire, even at Helm's Deep. But somehow they get out of that one. And now, you know, they're seeing all this stuff and it's just like these fairy tales come into life. And it's kind of like that, what a time to be alive.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking when I was reading this, this is a very corny reference, it's like the scene in Jurassic Park when they like first see the like giant herbivores for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy shit, there's dinosaurs. And that I'm sure that that's kind of the sensation that Tolkien's trying to convey here, or what you're saying is like how shocking this would be to the people, the normal people of Rohan, to see something like the Ents. Like, it's an equivalent level of like totally different time and sort of sense of the world and what's going on than what they thought was, you know, reality.
Yeah, I tried to think of like, is there like a historical event that could be compared to this? I thought of one. If you have one, say it now.
Well, this is not a historical event by any means, but that was what I thought of, was like, right, it would be like the equivalent of seeing dinosaurs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so my thought would be, this is what it was like for the apostles and the rest of the early Christians at like the resurrection. That was very difficult for all of them to believe that Jesus came back to life, you know, and they physically saw him and like, you know, touched his wounds and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's still so unbelievable that the majority of people don't believe that today, you know, mm-hmm. which, I mean, I don't know. That's a whole different conversation and stuff, mm-hmm. but it's just like, yeah, this is, I don't know. That's the only event that kind of is on par with the level of like ridiculousness that's going on here, I'd say.
Another aspect I think is like, if you study geology or any sort of outer space stuff, like when you start to think about like the timeline of the Earth, like the age of rocks or the age of anything in outer space, it dwarfs the age of humanity by such a ridiculous amount that is like, it's, you know, it's not even comparable. And that's kind of what Gandalf was saying about the Ents. Like, you know, the lifetime of men is like the blink of an eye for these right. Ents. You right. know, you've your entire civilization and everything that you understand to be your history and culture is like a blink of an eye for these creatures that have been around since the start of the world.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that line from Gandalf was cool. You are not without allies, even if you know them not. You know, it's like, these guys, they're way older than you, and Théoden knows that he's picking up too. He's kind of sad. It's like, wow, I do get to see him, but like, they're probably not going to be around forever. You know, they've been around for a very long time, and I'm like nothing to them. But even they're going to pass away too, which is sad. Still, these people are in the fight with us. You know, they're risking their necks for the same cause as us. You know, mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool to start seeing this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Gandalf's line about, you know, we can't undo all of the evil of Sauron. Interesting, but he just says, you know, we got to just keep plugging along at what we're doing now. Like, we're not going to, like, you know, avoid it and forget about it. But we're in the middle of the mission right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they come to the fords, and the riverbed's almost dry. That's very weird, because this river is usually pretty flowing, you know, like it's a ford. So, like, that means you walk through on, like, the shallow part that you can get across, right?
Right, right.
So all the riders that died at the ford are buried on the Eyot. Remember we had an Eyot before on the Great River?
Yeah, it was an isle, right? A small right. isle in the river.
Yeah, I always imagine it's, like, more stony or something, but I guess it could have, like, dirt and grass or something, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much is there. Anyways, that's where they buried the people, and they're surrounded by their spears. What does Éomer say here?
Here let them rest, said Éomer, and when their spears have rotted and rusted, long still may their mounds stand and guard the fords of Isen.
Is this your work also, Gandalf, my friend, said Théoden? You accomplished much in an evening and a night.
With the help of Shadowfax and others, said Gandalf, I rode fast and far. But here beside the mound I will say this for your comfort. Many fell in the battles of the fords, but fewer than rumor made them. More were scattered than were slain. I gathered them together, all that I could find. Some men I sent with Grimbold of Westfold to join Erkenbrand. Some I set to make this burial. They have now followed your marshal, Elfhelm. I sent him with many riders to Edoras.
All right, cool. So Gandalf filling us in a little bit about, like, what happened. So now the men that would have died at the fords, these were the people that were under the command of Théodred, who was Théoden's son. Because mm-hmm. Éomer's only his nephew. Mm-hmm. It's not his son. And so this
strikes close to home for Théoden.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I forget if they recovered Théodred's body and brought it back to Edoras for his dad to see, or if he's buried with them. I can't really remember. Anyways, though, if you're more interested in this battle, we actually have an account of it. It's at the end of Unfinished Tales. We're not going to go over here because this is going to be a long episode either way. But, you know, again, this is Théoden's son. He was a really good guy. He opposed Wormtongue with Éomer, you know, from the start. And so Saruman, he knew that Théodred would be defending the fords. Whenever this battle took place about a week ago, Saruman sent all his fiercest warriors to the ford specifically to kill Théodred so that Wormtongue would have to only separate Éomer from Théoden, you know, because it's like it'll be really hard to get the dad and the son separated,
mm-hmm.
but I could get this younger cousin and Théoden separated pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
was the thought process or whatever.
To divide the leadership and kind of break down the kingdom from within.
Right. So after Théodred was killed, Saruman actually let up for a couple days, and this was a mistake. Because when he lets up like that, that's when Gandalf comes to Théoden, and then they all rally. He rallies all the troops, and they all start going to Helm's Deep and stuff. Whereas if Saruman didn't hold up for, like, just 2 or 3 days, if he just pressed the attack right away, there'd be an army showing up to Edoras by the time Gandalf got there.
Mm.
So, again, you can read all about this in Unfinished Tales. Théodred was a tank, as per usual, to be expected, you know. Like, the good guys are really good, you know. Mm-hmm. When it's just, like, an offhand account of, like, some good guy or something, it's like, yeah, they're a good guy. He's mm-hmm. as cool as Helm Hammerhand, you know.
But it's worth noting at this little segment that Gandalf he conducts things really expertly, or did up until this point, where he's gathering people, sending them this way and that, and he's kind of exhibiting, I guess, like, good general characteristics, he sends off this group under Elfhelm to guard Edoras, to protect from, even though he knows that most of Saruman's army has been caught and destroyed at Helm's Deep, raiders might go for Edoras. So he sent a guard, a group to protect Edoras, and then sent the other group to Helm's Deep. So he's kind of masterminded this thing behind the scenes, all that where we didn't know where he went in the previous two chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of to be expected, though. It's like, oh, Gandalf, you know, he's got everything covered.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like when he comes in with these master save the day situations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. They camp a bit past the fords for the night, and then they see a spire of smoke and vapor rising from Isengard. Mm-hmm. And Éomer says the smoke is pretty common, but the steam's not. And he says Saruman's probably brewing some new devilry to greet them. Maybe he's boiling all the waters of Isen, and that's why the river runs dry, possibly. So we'll see. Gandalf's kind of like, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. So while they're sleeping, something blacker than night creeps past them. The description is kind of cool, but let's just move on. He doesn't directly say it, but it becomes obvious that it's the forest. So like the forest that they walk through, it's like passing them back now to rejoin to Fangorn.
Yeah, it sounds really spooky, but there's the brief mention of moving towers of shadow.
Yeah.
I think that was the most specific tree-like reference that I heard. Otherwise, it's like an earthquake and darkness and rustling all at the same time.
And Gandalf's still giving the directions like, hey, just stay calm. Do not interfere with them. They won't interfere with you.
Uh-huh.
And also, the orc bodies are all gone that were piled up outside the Hornburg. So maybe they ate them or something. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like they made some sort of like orc grave almost, like piled it up with rocks, and then nothing ever grew there in front of Helm's Deep where all the orc bodies were.
Yeah. Okay. And then the last detail is the river started flowing again. So this is strange how the river doesn't have water and then it does have water. So we're going to have to get to the bottom of that. Which, let's hit that right now. All right, so they come to the Nan Curunir, the Wizard's Vale. And so it used to be a really lush and beautiful place. Now it's super barren. What's your opinion? Do we have time to read some paragraphs, what it was like? Or should we just keep going?
Sure. It was a sheltered valley, open only to the south. Once it had been fair and green, and through it the Isen flowed, already deep and strong, before it found the plains, for it was fed by many springs and lesser streams among the rain-washed hills, and all about it there had lain a pleasant, fertile land. It was not so now. Beneath the walls of Isengard there still were acres tilled by the slaves of Saruman, but most of the valley had become a wilderness of weeds and thorns. Brambles trailed upon the ground, or clambering over bush and bank, made shaggy caves where small beasts housed. No trees grew there, but among the rank grasses there could still be seen the burned and axe-hewn stumps of ancient groves. It was a sad country, silent now but for the stony noise of quick waters. Smokes and streams drifted in sullen clouds and lurked in the hollows. The riders did not speak. Many doubted in their hearts, wondering to what dismal end their journey led.
Ominous. All right. Okay, so then they keep going. They pass this big pillar with a white hand pointing north, and it's super misty, so they can't see very far ahead, so they really just don't know what they're walking into.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get a description of Isengard in its heyday, like back when it was nice.
Mm-hmm.
As
the story's told of it.
Yeah. One who passed in and came at length out of the echoing tunnel beheld a plain, a great circle somewhat hollowed in a vast bowl, a mile it measured from room to room. Once it had been green and filled with avenues and groves of fruitful trees and watered by streams that flowed from the mountains to a lake. But no green thing grew there in the latter days of Saruman. The roads were paved with flagstones, dark and hard, and beside their borders, instead of trees, there marched long lines of pillars, some of marble, some of copper and of iron, joined by heavy chains. There's more description of Isengard itself, but let's skip down to the Tower Orthanc.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take that to the center? It's the bottom paragraph.
To the center, all the roads ran between their chains. There stood a tower of marvelous shape. It was fashioned by the builders of old, who smoothed the ring of Isengard, and yet it seemed a thing not made by the craft of men, but riven from the bones of the earth in the ancient torment of the hills. A peak and isle of rock it was, black and gleaming hard. Four mighty piers, many-sided stone, were welded into one. But near the summit they opened into gaping horns, their pinnacles sharp as the points of spears, keen-edged as knives. Between them was a narrow space, and there upon a floor of polished stone, written with strange signs, a man might stand 500 feet above the plain. This was Orthanc, the citadel of Saruman, the name of which had, by design or by chance, a twofold meaning. For in the Elvish speech, Orthanc signifies Mount Fang, but in the language of the Mark of old, the cunning mind. A strong place and wonderful was Isengard, and long it had been beautiful, and there great lords had dwelt, the wardens of Gondor upon the west, and wise men that watched the stars. But Saruman had slowly shaped it to his shifting purposes, and made it better, as he thought, being deceived, for all those arts and subtle devices for which he forsook his former wisdom, and which fondly he imagined were his own, came but from Mordor, so that what he made was not, only a little copy, a child's model or a slave's flattery, of that vast fortress, armory, prison, furnace of great power, Barad-dûr, the dark tower, which suffered no rival, and laughed at flattery, biding its time, secure in its pride and its immeasurable strength. This was the stronghold of Saruman, as fame reported it, for within living memory the men of Rohan had not passed its gates, save perhaps a few, such as Wormtongue, who came in secret and told no man what they saw.
Alright, so, this book is called The Two Towers. It's probably fair game to assume this is one of those towers.
Mm-hmm.
We won't talk about Orthanc tonight. Hopefully I remember to do it in, like, the next chapter or two. But yeah, thoughts.
Well, first of all, this is a super architecturally interesting vision for this whole fortress. It's like a giant circular wall that's filled with houses inside the wall. Like, the wall is occupied. And there's windows looking out. And then this big field, which was once filled with gardens and trees. And then this huge tower rising out of the middle. It's just, like, such a beautiful vision, I think. But clear how it's also like a very powerful thing, like this tower right in the center of the giant circle, and it's been corrupted basically, and all the trees cut down,
and the tower was built by men originally.
Yeah, but it's got this sort of surreal quality where it suggests that you don't see the stones joined together or something. It looks like it's just sheer rock, which is really cool.
Well, I think it was built by the Numenoreans in, like, the height of their power, I believe. So this is, like, when they were probably at their best for building purposes, architecture purposes, any sort of art, really.
Yeah. And then the description, like you said, of... we're not talking about Orthanc versus Barad-dûr right now.
Yeah, we'll do the name of Orthanc later, because I forgot to get those notes, but
okay.
but compared to Barad-dûr, so first of all, yeah, so now, you know, it was this beautiful place. What is it like now?
It sounds like dark, terrifying, hard stone.
Real world example. Concentration camp.
Yeah.
Or like the gulags.
Basically.
It's a workers' camp.
Yeah. Cold and hard, and there's steam coming out of the earth, and there's slaves working the fields and the equipment.
Yep.
And that description of Barad-dûr and the Saruman thought he was improving this tower. Really, he was just making this sort of perverse flattery of a tower that could not ever be replicated. This, like, infinitely powerful Barad-dûr, which I thought was just such a good description. Like, that... kind of like you were saying earlier, that just that conversation between Theoden and Gandalf sums up so much about the book. This little description sums up so much about the evil side of the book against the good side of, like, these are the two bad guys, and this one Saruman thinks he's powerful, thinks he's doing great things, and instead he's just corrupting something that was good in service of evil.
Right. So, yeah. And once again, like, even evil, like, Saruman, it's almost so lame. It's impressive, but it's so lame compared to the real thing in Mordor. You know, evil can't make anything new. It always copies. But now, here's an even lamer example where evil is trying to copy evil, and it's just an even lesser thing, you know? And it's interesting how Tolkien can just put that, you know, in the narrative just as he's describing the whole tower. Like, that's pretty impressive powers on his part. And of course, like, in this one, you know, this does his whole view of evil, like, that's always almost always tied to some sort of theological thought. And Fleming Rutledge, she pointed out, she has this quote: "Here once again is the apocalyptic viewpoint that Tolkien shares with the New Testament. There are forces at work beyond what we vainly imagine to be our own autonomous wills. Saruman thinks he is free, but he is actually being controlled by Mordor. So all he can do is make small-scale imitations of the immense reality of the powers of sin and death. Dante suggests this also many times in The Inferno. There is no real freedom outside the will of God. The paradox is that slavery to the will of God is the only true freedom." All right, see. Okay, so Gandalf bravely continues in the mist. He's also really just not even freaking out. So it's almost like he's not even being brave. He's just like, yep, let's go. And then they come to the doors of Isengard, and then we get some fun quotes going. So let's do this.
When we got the description of Isengard, it's worth noting these were giant steel doors set in this like imposing stone wall. And they were hinged. They're built so artfully that they could be pushed with a single touch by a single man opening the doors when they were unlatched. So hinges rooted in the ground, very strong and very well built. And so now, but the doors lay hurled and twisted on the ground, and all about, stone, cracked and splintered into countless jagged shards, was scattered far and wide, or piled in ruinous heaps. The great arch still stood, but it opened now upon a roofless chasm. The tunnel was laid bare, and through the cliff-like walls on either side, great rents and breaches had been torn. Their towers were beaten into dust. If the great sea had risen in wrath and fallen on the hills with storm, it could have worked no greater ruin. The ring beyond was filled with steaming water, a bubbling cauldron, in which there heaved and floated a wreckage of beams and spars, chests and casks and frozen gear. Twisted and leaning pillars reared their splintered stems above the flood, but all the roads were drowned. Far off, it seemed, half-veiled in winding crowd, there loomed the island rock. Still tall and dark, unbroken by the storm, the Tower of Orthanc stood, pale waters lapped about its feet. The king and all his company sat silent on their horses, marveling, perceiving that the power of Saruman was overthrown. But how, they could not guess. And now they turned their eyes toward the archway and the ruined gates. There they saw, close beside them, a great rubble heap, and suddenly they were aware of two small figures lying on it at their ease, gray-clad, hardly to be seen among the stones. There were bottles and bowls and platters laid beside them, as if they had just eaten well, and now rested from their labor. One seemed asleep, the other, with crossed legs and arms behind his head, leaned back against a broken rock, and sent from his mouth long wisps and little rings of thin blue smoke.
That's a pretty good description. First of all, very vivid to describe, I don't know, almost like a junkyard, or like just a previous battle zone, really, whatever it was. And then all of a sudden you just turn it, and it gets goofy, because we see who's back.
Well, it would seem Merry and Pippin. I was going to say there's a distinct visual contrast. We've got this huge fortress, which is now, you know, in ruin. Chunks of stone laying around, flooded with water, steaming, and smoking. And then we've got Merry and Pippin laying around, thing like plates and bottles cast aside, smoking. It's kind of a funny, like, you know, parallel imagery.
This is like peak stereotypical hobbits.
Yes. And Tolkien's clearly having some fun with it, as we'll see.
Oh yeah. So let's keep going here. For the moment, Théoden and Éomer and all his men stared at them in wonder. You know, more of the men just can't believe what they're seeing. Amid all the wreck of Isengard, this seemed to them the strangest sight. But before the king could speak, the small, smoke-breathing figure became suddenly aware of them, as they sat there silent on the edge of the mist. He sprang to his feet. A young man he looked, or like one, though not much more than half a man in height.
His head of brown curly hair was uncovered, but he was clad in a travel-stained cloak of the same hue and shape as the companions of Gandalf had worn when they rode to Edoras. He bowed very low, putting his hand upon his breast. Then, seeming not to observe the wizard and his friends, he turned to Éomer and the king.
"Welcome, my lords, to Isengard," he said. "We are the Door Wardens. Meriadoc, son of Saradoc, is my name, and my companion, who, alas, is overcome with weariness," here he gave another dig with his foot, "is Peregrin, son of Paladin, of the House of Took. Far in the north is our home. The Lord Saruman is within, but at the moment he is closeted with one Wormtongue, or doubtless he would be here to welcome such honorable guests."
"Doubtless he would," laughed Gandalf. "And was it Saruman that ordered you to guard his damaged doors and watch for the arrival of guests when your attention could be spared from plate and bottle?"
"No, good sir, the matter escaped him," answered Merry gravely. "He has been much occupied. Our orders came from Treebeard, who has taken over the management of Isengard. He commanded me to welcome the Lord of Rohan with fitting words. I have done my best."
"And what about your companions? What about Legolas and me?" cried Gimli, unable to contain himself longer. "You rascals, you woolly-footed and woolly-padded truants. A fine hunt you have led us, 200 leagues through fen and forest, battle and death, to rescue you. And here we find you feasting and idling, and smoking. Smoking? Where did you come by the weed, you villains? Hammer and tongs. I am so torn between rage and joy that if I do not burst, it will be a marvel."
"You speak for me," Gimli laughed Legolas, "though I would sooner learn how they came by the wine."
"One thing you have not found in your hunting, and that's brighter wits," said Pippin, opening an eye. "Here you find us sitting on a field of victory amid the plunder of armies, and you wonder how we came by a few well-earned comforts?" "Well-earned," said Gimli, "I cannot believe that."
The riders laugh.
So that is a, I don't know, just an excellent reunion right there. Mm-hmm. Token's good at this, dude. This is, he's my favorite for a reason. Mm-hmm. And again, yeah, this is just most stereotypical Hobbit you could ever get. Yeah, well, let's keep going here with it. We're reading most of this because it's going to be important, because I got a big chunk of notes afterwards that, you know, just going through all of this is actually beneficial. It's not just because we enjoy it, though we do. Okay, so Théoden starts. He says, "It cannot be doubted that we witnessed a meeting of dear friends," said Théoden. "So these are the lost ones of your company, Gandalf. The days are fated to be filled with marvels. Already I have seen many since I left my home, and now here before my eyes stand yet another of the folk of legend. Are not these the halflings that some among us call the Hobbitland?"
"Hobbits, if you please, lord," said Pippin.
"Hobbits," said Théoden. "Your tongue is strangely changed, but the name sounds not unfitting so. Hobbits. No report that I have heard does justice to the truth."
Merry bowed, and Pippin got up and bowed low. "You are gracious, lord, or I hope that I may so take your words," he said. "And here is another marvel. I have wandered in many lands since I left my home, and never till now have I found people that knew any story concerning hobbits."
"My people came out of the north long ago," said Théoden, "but I will not deceive you. We know no tales about hobbits. All that is said among us is that far away, over many hills and rivers, live the halfling folk that dwell in holes and sand dunes. But there are no legends of their deeds, for it is said they do little, and avoid the sight of men, being able to vanish in a twinkling, and they can change their voices to resemble the piping of birds. But it seems that more could be said."
"It could indeed, lord," said Merry.
"For one thing," said Théoden, "I had not heard that they spouted smoke from their mouths."
"That is not surprising," answered Merry, "for it is an art which we have not practiced for more than a few generations. It was Tobold Hornblower of Longbottom in the south farthing, who first grew the true pipeweed in his gardens, about the year 1070, according to our reckoning. How old Toby came by the plant?"
"You do not know your danger," Théoden interrupted Gandalf. "These hobbits will sit on the edge of ruin and discuss the pleasures of table or the small doings of their fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers, and remoter cousins to the ninth degree, if you encourage them with undue patience. Some other time would be more fitting for the history of smoking. Where is Treebeard, Merry?" So that was also cool. Uh-huh. That was really good. So Rohan, those guys came, and I think we'll eventually talk about this at some point, but Rohan, remember they came out of the north, that Errol the young guy led them out and they helped save Gondor in a battle, and mm-hmm. that's how they got rewarded with the land. I think they came from a place where the hobbits used to live, you know, like where Gollum was around.
Okay.
You know, because the hobbits
remember when we talked all the way back in the prologue episode how the hobbits crossed the Misty Mountains and then they went to Bree and then they ended up settling in the Shire? I think where they were situated was where the Rohirrim people used to live in the north as well.
Okay, interesting.
So that's potentially how Théoden has heard a hint of them and has a word that sounds kind of like it, the Hobbitlin.
Yeah.
Hobbitlin.
So yet another example of Théoden coming across creatures from ancient tales that he didn't think were real. And then also we've seen quite a few introductions now of hobbits, people being confused with what hobbits are, and hobbits saying like, hey, we're here too, and we're one of the races of creatures or what have you.
Yeah,
which is always kind of funny. And where was I going with this? Sorry.
Théoden with creatures.
Totally lost my train of thought. Anyways, we've got Théoden once again confronting the stuff of legend. We've got the hobbits reintroducing, having to constantly reassert themselves.
Yeah.
It seems like nobody knows who they are, which brings us full circle in some ways. Like it maybe resets like the groundwork for some of this quest of like the hobbits being such a mystery thrown into this mix of men and elves and dwarves going off to war. So it's kind of heartwarming and peculiar at the same time.
Yeah. Alright, so let's just finish off the reading of this chapter. Merry gives him the situation about like what the Ents are doing or where Treebeard is or whatnot. Anyways, he tells Gandalf and Théoden to go meet Treebeard on the north side of Isengard, and they have food for him there, which the hobbits picked out themselves. So, and then you want to take Gandalf left?
Gandalf laughed. That is better, he said. Well, Théoden, will you ride with me to find Treebeard? We must go round about, but it is not far. When you see Treebeard, you will learn much, for Treebeard is Fanghorn, the eldest and chief of the Ents, and when you speak with him, you will hear the speech of the oldest of all living things.
I will come with you, said Théoden. Farewell, my hobbits. May we meet again in my house. There you shall sit beside me and tell me all that your hearts desire, the deeds of your grandsires, as far as you can reckon them. And we will speak also of Tolbit the Old and his Herblore. Farewell.
The hobbits bowed low. So that is the King of Rohan, said Pippin in an undertone. A very fine old fellow. Very polite.
Excellent. That was cool. So when I was originally doing the notes for this chapter, I just had a ton for this. And I was like, how do I have so much? And then I started reading through them and it's like, oh, right. I totally forgot the existence of this section. So this is a big, I don't know. This is one of like a new theme or conversation or topic that we have to introduce. And I think this is about the only time we'll do like a real full depth look at it, but we really can't pass it up because it's the best opportunity to do it. So first of all, very cool and notable that these strangers who they know they should be friendly with each other are just so polite right away. So, you know, and just happy to meet. Great sign of friendship and union there, you know, and that's definitely something you're never going to see with any of our encounters with like the orcs or something.
Right. It contributes to that feel, the jovial feeling of this chapter that we described at the beginning.
Right, absolutely, yeah. Like, really ends it on a real high note, too. Now, so once Lord of the Rings is produced, it kind of defines the fantasy genre. You know, like, there's all sorts of, like, heroic, you know, stories like this that come after it. But before it was released, or, you know, before it got popular, it's like, how would you classify Lord of the Rings? Would it be like a novel or like a romance thing or like an epic? You know, it is pretty tough to actually pinpoint exactly where it fits in, you know? So what Tom Shippey was talking about in, well, both his books, he said that there's this book called The Anatomy of Criticism by Northrop Frye that came out in 1957, so right after Lord of the Rings. And so Frye says there's five very general literary modes of like what any work would fit into. Okay. And these are going to be defined by the nature of the characters is how he did it in this book, apparently.
Okay.
So the highest literary mode at the top is myth. And so this is where the characters are basically kind of superhuman to like other men and to their environment that they're in. Okay.
Okay.
One level down from that is what he calls romance. And so this is where the characters are superior in a degree to other men and the environment. So it's like kind of above it, right?
Okay.
I don't know. I guess that's what I kind of interpreted to mm-hmm. degree means. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, in the same plane, but at a higher level.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the next level, so the third level of this is what he calls high mimesis. And so this is kind of like the tragedies and epics, you know. So like the hero is superior in degree to other men, but not to the natural environment. There's other forces around that he's not more powerful than.
Okay.
He's not above. Okay. Next to the bottom is low mimesis. And so this is kind of, now you start to get into like even more somewhat just even somewhat modern novels, you know, like we're talking within like the past like 300 years or something. Mm-hmm. And this is where you see characters on the same level as us, the readers, though they might be in like a different social class or, you know, it's like maybe like a higher class that we can't quite relate to, but it's like they're us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then last comes irony, is what he calls like the ironic literary mode, where we see ourselves, us, we look down at weaker people that are more ignorant than us in the books themselves. So mm-hmm. like you're looking at lesser people basically.
Mm-hmm.
So Fry observes that for 1500 years, the past 1500 years, from a literary perspective, we've been moving from myth down to romance to high mimesis and then down to like low mimesis, because that's kind of like what all the books are about in Tolkien's time. So mm-hmm. you know, when Tolkien set out to do this, that's kind of a problem for him. His readers are all used to either the low mimetic or the ironic expectations. And it's like, well, that's not what he wants to do here. You know, like he wants to go up and do something different. So right. How could he present his heroes to the audience that are trained to reject this very style? Like they don't want anything. They're used to and don't want anything above like the low mimetic style at this point. Is what Shippey's
okay. arguing. Okay.
So the solution to this is that in Lord of the Rings, you have a hierarchy of styles within it. In Lord of the Rings, there's characters at all five of these levels.
Mm.
Okay? So the hobbits, usually the low mimetic. Okay? So that's kind of like the common thing. You know, they're mm-hmm. slightly foreign to us, but they're kind of pretty common. If anything, Sam's actually, a lot of times, he's at that ironic level where he seems like he's the lowest character. Anytime he talks, the stylistic level seems to drop, you know, because he's such like a plain speaker.
Right. It's almost to the point of comic relief when he talks sometimes, because he's so like, you know, farm boy, aloof to a lot of the other things that are going on. Of course, yeah. I mean, ironic is a good term, though, because he tends to be very astute in his observations in his own way.
Right. But in Shippey says like this like kind of captures it. He says, even in scenes tending toward the mythic, like the rope crossing scene in Lorien, Sam kind of just ruins it, you know, cause he could, like, he was the one that was like scared to walk across. Like it was super cool. Like we all were having fun with it. And then it's like, oh, but then Sam walks up there and he's just nervous. And he's just like, it's not as cool now. Cause he's just a wreck, you know, mm-hmm. trying to get across it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Loki thing that we got to keep watching out for is I don't think Sam stays at that low ironic mm-hmm, level mm-hmm. for the entirety of the book, but we got to keep tabs.
Well, but it's worth, maybe you're just about to get to this, but it's really important in a situation like that. You might say that he ruins it by introducing this sort of low level of writing into the high mythic quality of everything else, but that's what establishes a connection. That's the bridge for us, yeah. the reader, to with an experience with modern literature, to understand and relate to something that is set in a tone of like ancient mythic literature.
Right. Yeah. I want to give more examples about who, you know, represents what here. So most okay. of the men, so we're thinking like Eomer and Boromir, maybe Théoden, but he's a little bit tougher to kind of place. You know, these are the kind of guys, these guys are leaders and stuff. So they, and along with Aragorn, even at points, they kind of represent the high mimesis, you know? Uh-huh. So like Aragorn, I think he's probably closer to romance in my opinion, just yeah. personally. But I mean, yeah, they're superior to just the average man. Like the common thing is the average guys like us reading it are like the low mimesis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Eomer and Boromir, way braver than us.
Mm-hmm.
Going like on epic heroic battles, you know, right. like leading people through charges and stuff. So it's like, yeah, they're right. I would say they're a little bit higher, and then Aragorn's definitely right there up with them, or he's even higher than that.
But much like we might read a modern day story that is realistic, like not fantastical in any way, maybe, yeah. Or even like a nonfiction biography that's about, you know,
like Unbroken,
a famous general or soldier or politician or what have you, yeah. Actor, who knows what. That yeah, is like, that's the high mimesis you're talking about, right? They are
real people. Like Julius Caesar.
They're also humans. We understand that they exist in the world that we exist in, but they're obviously like have a larger role, a greater power and importance in the world that we are in.
Yeah. So think like Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, those kinds of people.
Yeah.
Now, Chippy's going to say that any of the non-humans, so like elves and even the dwarves, he's going to consider them at like the romance level, so that second highest level,
mm-hmm.
which I definitely get for the elves for sure. Sometimes I think the dwarves are like, I would put them at like almost our level, maybe the high, but maybe even the low mimesis, but whatever. And then guys like Gandalf and even Sauron and even Bombadil, these are the guys that are like just way, way up there, and they approach like the mythic level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what categorizes that is like they're characters that are superhuman, you know, to other men and the environment. Like neither mm-hmm. have an effect on them. The most powerful people in these books really do approach that.
Yeah, and they maybe another aspect is that they kind of hold wisdom that we couldn't reasonably expect any normal character to have.
Yeah, so now, why we're talking about this here, the conversation that we just read between Theoden and Gandalf and the Hobbits and Legolas and Gimli as well, they were probably crossing between all five levels in this conversation.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's like the collision of everything.
Right, exactly.
We've got
Masterstroke by Tolkien, yeah.
Even though Ents aren't part of the conversation, they're fresh in everyone's mind. Discussions about the oldest living things
you will
ever hear from, and their presence in the world is that mythic quality. And then all the way down to Merry and Pippin sitting around smoking.
Yeah, or talking about the history of smoking.
Surrounded by their dirty plates as they greet these famous guys. You know, they're like the...
Well, Pippin's sleeping through the greeting, too.
Right. They're like the jokester imposters who, you know, in case this was all feeling very highfalutin with this last battle and everything, this brings it back to the reader who might have, you know, established a connection with the Hobbits early on.
Yeah, it's fun. Chippy's just got a couple more quotes here. We'll read the one and then maybe we'll just, you know, we'll finish with the other. The whole story furthermore aspires in places to mythic meaning, as discussed above. The aspiration is limited only by Tolkien's refusal to reach out to do more than hint at a sixth level above and outside Fry's categorizations, which one could call true myth, or gospel, or revelation, or Tolkien's word, evangelium. In his essay on fairy stories, he argued that fairy tales could have a glimpse or gleam of this through eucatastrophe, but should not allow it in, as rending the very web of the story. That's a little bit out there from what we were just saying, but does that make sense?
I think so. I mean, it's kind of like the beyond the ancient epic tone of things happening above our plane of existence is like a higher plane of spirituality, almost like religious texts.
Right. Well, maybe that's what he's saying. He says it there with like the gospel. It's just like, right. That's the true story. You know, it's like the greatest myth, but then it's also true. So it's like a level above that, you know, mm-hmm. like it's a level above that highest fifth one, you know, so. Mm-hmm. But then also, you know, he's saying like, and you can glimpse that kind of with like the eucatastrophes. We had a big example of the eucatastrophe when Gandalf showed up at the end of the last chapter with Erkenbrand and the rest of the troops and the forces out there. But in this one, I think it was so pleasant because there was just a bunch of mini, like the eucatastrophe things kept coming up. You know, like anytime like Théoden's just impressed, like, wow, it's strange times. It's like, I think every single one of those is kind of like the mini eucatastrophe going on. Mm. You know, throughout this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why we enjoyed it so much, is because these kept coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've heard the five levels, and they're more so based off the characters, according to what we're saying there. But the story as a whole, where do you put it, Lord of the Rings? Is it myth? Is it romance? Is it high mimesis, low mimesis, or is it the irony? Obviously, characters are switching between all five levels. But, like, as a whole, if you average it all out, where does this fall?
My first answer was going to be that it's all of them, and that's what makes it so interesting and unique. But I do feel like this is not the exact answer to your question, but I do feel like it's in the mythical plane,
mm-hmm.
that the highest level it's just the modern incarnation of that. You know, that's ultimately like what Tolkien kind of strove to make, was like, how do I bring ancient myth into common literature? And I feel like he achieved that. And it's, there's bits of everything, as we're saying, but it's, that's ultimately its success, is writing something that is at that highest plane that people understand and relate to and find palatable and enjoyable and legible. What do you think?
Well, I already read Shippy's answer. Okay. So I can't really weigh in and take a guess at this. But okay. I think his would just be a good... I'll just read it and that'll be the end for us.
Okay.
Okay, so he says, in brief, then, Lord of the Rings is a romance, but one which is in continuous negotiation with and which follows many of the conventions of the traditional bourgeois novel. All the levels, however, interact continually and challengingly. Gandalf, Aragorn, Théoden, Merry and Pippin can all be found together in scenes like the arrival at Isengard, representing, as it were, all five of Fry's levels at once. They move easily from amiable hobbitic prattle about pipeweed to the speech of the oldest of all living things, and intensively suggest remarks about the nature of chance and luck. The flexibility with which Tolkien moves between the modes is a major cause for the success of Lord of the Rings. It is at once ambitious, much more so than novels are allowed to be, and insidious, getting under the guard of the modern reader trained to reject or to ironize the assumptions of tragedy or epic. This is how Tolkien, in the end, solved the problem first set up in The Hobbit, of bringing together the modern world of the Shire and the Bagginses, and the heroic world of werebears and dragons and Thor and Oakenshield. So we were kind of right. You were right.
Nice.
All right, Clifford, back again for another ending.
Yes, we are.
We're doing, this is the ending to the Road to Isengard chapter.
Okay, sweet.
So, I think I mentioned before, remember when you were in town, I got the Worlds of J.R. Tolkien by John Garth.
Mm-hmm.
So, I finished this book a couple weeks ago. It was like the only thing I actually read during the tour.
Okay.
Like I said before, I was reading this one basically just for pleasure because I didn't want to put in the effort to take notes on it. It's too much, you know, and I had other stuff going on. But just to give like an excerpt of how good this thing was, for this chapter, this was the one with where Gimli gives the description of the glittering caves.
Okay.
So what he covers is all sorts of places in Middle-earth that would have affected Tolkien.
Okay.
You know, like, or, I'm sorry, places in real life that inspired places in Middle-earth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an example, there's a pretty spinning image thing that would have inspired him for the glittering caves. So let me just read this. It's a little bit long, but it's pretty good. One extraordinary piece of description comes directly from experience. Gimli's account of the glittering caves of Aglarond behind Helm's Deep. Tolkien told the reader the passage was based on the caves in Cheddar Gorge and was written just after he revisited these in 1940, but was still colored by my memory of them much earlier, before they became so commercialized. The caves around Cheddar, tunneled by rainwater and subterranean streams in the Carboniferous limestone of the Mendip Hills, were a wonder in Tolkien's childhood. One complex, extending more than 2 miles, was opened up by Richard Gow and his sons from 1892 to 1898. Half a mile of this became a show cave lit by electricity, with areas dubbed the Swiss Village, St. Paul's, Solomon's Temple, and Aladdin's Cave. Visiting on their honeymoon in 1916, Tolkien and Edith probably saw this and neighboring Cox Cave, described in one book as a gem of fantastic architecture, embellished with the most lawless and fairy-like designs of the subterranean artificer. Pretty good inspiration, like spitting image.
Yeah, super cool.
And yeah, this book's got tons of good pictures, so like you would actually want to buy the physical copy. And I made it the coffee table book of the house.
Nice.
And I've gotten multiple compliments.
Great.
Many people pick it up and peruse, so.
Okay, cool.
What else is up with you?
Not much here. Yeah. Same as it's been. Sticking at it, working.
You know what you gotta do?
What?
You have to read the awesome book that I finished this weekend.
Which was?
Endurance by Alfred Lansing. It's a book about the ship called the Endurance, led by
Shackleton.
Yeah, Shackleton. Okay. Oh man,
he goes to Antarctica and gets stranded.
Well, before they even land in Antarctica, they get stuck in a bunch of ice. So then basically kind of not quite glaciers, but they get stuck in the pack ice.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the sea surrounding Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And so they're stuck in there, and then eventually the ice crushes enough that it destroys their boat. So these guys have to go, there's like 28 of them. They have to live on the ice for basically over a year. And the boat's completely destroyed, and nobody knows that they're out here. Nobody's going to come and get them. Like, they just assume they're dead or they'll make it, you know, because you can't, it's too dangerous down there. But anyways, they make it out, and it was just an incredible story. Basically, they have a couple rowboats that are left over, and they sail, like, they end up getting back to civilization, and it's absolutely wild. Every page, I mean, it doesn't let up until the very last page. They get through challenge after challenge, and you're just like, oh my gosh, what's like, and then you think that they're done, and it's like, nope, they got to do this. And it's like, oh, how much can they take? You know, how much do they go through? It's insane. It was so awesome. Such an awesome book. And cool. Shackleton, what a leader. What a guy. It was pretty wild.
Okay. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, no, everybody has to check it out. That's why I'm mentioning it. This book. Oh, like Odysseus would be impressed.
That's awesome.
I don't know. That was about my week, though. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All
right. This is probably long enough then. So yeah, we gotta record another episode tonight, and then we're actually we don't have that many stocked up anymore.
Gotta stay on top of things now. Get back on track.
Yeah, we don't have far to go until we get to. You know, where we get to take another break from releasing them. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. Well, then, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week. We'll be back again with another one next week.
Yep. Thanks, Joe.